The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Reoccurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in his Washington Times column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for The Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you have questions, many questions, and generally, in church, you're discouraged from asking them. Not all churches, but a good number of them. And instead, you're told to accept things by faith. That always sounds nice. That sounds beautiful. That sounds poetic, worthy. Accept it by faith. But if that has been your experience, welcome, my friend. Welcome to our sanctuary, a sanctuary for skeptics and doubters. A person has a right to say, if I'm going to give my whole life to following God, how do I know God exists? If you're going to tell me that this God became a man in 33 AD and called himself Jesus Christ, how do I know that happened? Is there historical evidence? Is there archaeological evidence? Does God still speak? Well, answering these kinds of questions is what our program is all about. You're welcome to phone them in. For those of you that are shy about coming on the air, many people reach me these days through Facebook, Twitter, or by simple email, questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions@bobsiegel, SIEGEL.net. And I not only get questions from skeptics, but people who are in the church who want some of their theologies better explained. For example, this is somebody who contacted me through my website. Her name is Carol, and she read an article in the Free Republic, which says there will be no Antichrist. Now, that's a name that those of you not familiar with Christianity have probably at least heard in movies such as The Omen. They even did a remake of The Omen not long ago. Antichrist being defined in the Bible as an evil, deceptive dictator who will arrive on the scene someday shortly before the second coming of Christ. We don't know when the second coming will be. A lot of Christians believe we're living in the last generation to see that second coming, but Christians have believed that before in other generations. But whenever it happens, whether you believe it's next year, 7 years from now, or 1,000 years from now, the Bible does tell us that there's a person known as the Antichrist who's going to come first, or at least that's what many Christians believe. Now, there are some people that interpret the Bible differently. And this particular article that Carol's reading in Free Republic says there will be no Antichrist. Now, you can go to the Free Republic online, read that article for yourself. But I took a look at it in response to Carol's question. And if you're listening, Carol, the article is incorrect. There will be an Antichrist, and he will be a literal person. He is not always called the Antichrist in the Bible. Sometimes he's referred to as the man of lawlessness or the son of destruction. Now, this writer of the article you read, Carol, is correct about one thing. John does tell us, I mean the Apostle John in the book of 1 John, John does tell us that many antichrists will come, but there is a final, ultimate antichrist. It seems that at different stages of history, God sets up the world for the potential of Christ's return. And varying generations have their own antichrist. Then, in order to give people more time to repent, God postpones his decision. The postponing of the decision is mentioned in 1 Peter chapter 3, just so you know I'm not making this stuff up. So when the book of Revelation was written, Emperor Domitian was already pretty evil. He was insisting on being called Lord and God. There were policemen that went around, Roman police that went around to your house, and you had to have a certificate claiming that you'd gone and worshiped the emperor and lit incense to the emperor. I mean, you didn't literally face the emperor, but you'd go into these temples and you'd light it to Caesar, and the Caesar then was Emperor Domitian. So he was kind of an antichrist at that time. In fact, he had a reputation for being as wicked as Emperor Nero. Emperor Nero's name in Hebrew numerology, by the way, equaled 666. And that is what the 666 in the book of Revelation means. We watch history for a dictator like Nero, of whom there have been and will be many. If you had lived in the time of Adolf Hitler, when Hitler was trying to bring about, what did Hitler call the Third Reich? He called it Third Reich because it was supposed to be like a revived Roman Empire, being all over Europe. Hitler was an antichrist. Hitler was certainly as evil as Nero. Christians have done stupid things with the name 666 over the years. I remember when Ronald Reagan was elected, people were going, Ronald Wilson Reagan, each of those names has six letters in it. No, that's not what they're talking about. It means watch for somebody like Nero. And we have had many such dictators, but someday that dictator will be the last dictator. Someday that dictator will have a greater sphere of influence over the world. None of this takes away from the fact that ultimately there will be a genuine return of the real Jesus to defeat this final Antichrist. If one carefully and honestly reads the words of 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, they can reach no other conclusion. But one more thing before we move on to other questions. Christians have been disagreeing on this and other issues for ages. It is interesting. You can tell I get excited talking about it, but it's actually on my list of things that need not split a church. We as Christians must agree on who Jesus was, why he came, and how to be saved. Those three things are important. The other stuff, even when clear in the Bible, is not as important. And of course, there's all kinds of stuff Christians disagree about that's not clear in the Bible, like what kind of worship music we should listen to, et cetera. I think when people discuss this subject, then they should drop tones of arrogance or superiority over other pastors or theologians who disagree. Now, this next question is in response to what I said last week. I read a question from Mark and Santee about the baptism of the Holy Spirit, which is an experience that people claim is sometimes accompanied with tongues. And before I continue, I should mention I speak in tongues. Tongues is a spiritual gift. It's the ability to speak languages you have not learned. It's something supernatural. I'm saying this only. I'm not saying this to make a big deal out of it. I'm saying this because far too many Christians have made a big deal out of it. They've said that if you don't speak in tongues, you're not baptized in the Holy Spirit. Well, I mentioned last week that being baptized in the Holy Spirit and being saved are actually one and the same thing. I'm not going to go through all of that again. But in response to that discussion, I do have a question here. And usually, I never read a person's last name, but I'll usually read a first name. I'm not even going to read this person's first name. I'm withholding it because his church is local here in San Diego. And I don't want to get him in any trouble because he's going to talk a little bit about what goes on in church. He says, Bob, you mentioned speaking in tongues. Can anyone speak in tongues? Is that desirable? Doesn't Paul talk about that he wished everyone spoke in tongues, but to desire prophecy? I'm not sure I remember this correctly, and I haven't found the verse. Speaking and praying in tongues has become real big in our church. We prayed for a brother whose back was hurting, and a lot of people were praying in tongues out loud as we huddled around him and laid hands on him. It was a very confusing time for me. I want whatever God has for me, and I know his ways are not my ways. What are your thoughts on this? Well, first of all, my friend, I appreciate that you want whatever God has for you. And there are two extremes. There are people who say everybody should speak in tongues, and then there's a whole theology called dispensationalism that says God doesn't even give the gift out anymore. So what do we have? We have churches where nobody speaks in tongues. We have churches where everybody speaks in tongues, and they go, look, we're all speaking in tongues. That proves it's a gift for everybody. Because if it wasn't for everybody, how come we're all doing it? Well, I'll tell you why you're all doing it. Because those that don't do it are feeling intimidated and leaving your church. That's not spirituality. That's more like randomness and natural selection. Okay. Let me respond to the specific question, though. In 1 Corinthians 12, Paul asks a rhetorical question of which the answer is no. He says, do all speak in tongues? Tongues is a gift. Not all of us have to have the same gift. There is nothing wrong with desiring it. There's nothing wrong with asking God for it. But if he chooses not to supply that gift, I would not worry about it. As I said, I speak in tongues myself. So this is not from any lack of experience. It's not sour grapes. It's not my inability to relate to what other people are going through. And I hope this helps. Let me know if you have further questions. In a group setting, you asked about that. In a group setting, there should be an interpretation. Privately, one may use the gift without an interpretation as a prayer language. But even then, Paul said, he who speaks in a tongue should pray that he may interpret what he says. By the way, when Paul says, I want you all to speak in tongues, he means all who are so gifted or all who are so led. It was the same thing when he said two or three prophets should speak and the others would weigh carefully what they say. And if a prophecy comes to another person, the first person should sit down. Paul there was talking about order in the church. So he means those who have the gift of tongues, I want you all to use it, but take turns and do it in order. And it's interesting that this fellow talked about how it got confusing when everybody was speaking in tongues at the same time. Well, that's exactly what Paul was trying to avoid. Even in Paul's day, they had seeker-friendly church services. And he says, if somebody walks in and they're coming to your church for the first time and you're all speaking in other languages at once, he's going to think you're out of your mind. He's going to think you're insane. This is what Paul says. So again, like I said with the previous question, as Christians, we must agree on who Jesus is, why he came, and how to be saved. Well, in Pakistan, there are Christians who agree as to who Jesus was, but their Muslim neighbors do not like hearing about it. There is a woman in Pakistan that was sentenced to death. The charge was that she blasphemed Muhammad. Now, she doesn't believe Muhammad's a prophet if she's a Christian, but she claims she never even actually came out and said that in so many words. I'm going to tell you about this remarkable young lady because she needs our prayer. She needs us to write our congressman. She needs our help. She needs our country to step to the plate because Pakistan is supposed to be an ally. I can't imagine our president doing anything but cowering to Muslim countries. But, well, if all you can do is pray for her, I'm going to tell you a lot more about her when we come back. But before we visit the gloominess that can sometimes come with religion, let's be lifted up about religion.
Born in a stable, he came here for me. Born of a virgin, he came here for me. God's only son, come to set the world free. Born of God's love, and he came here for me. Say,
as if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170. 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook, Twitter, or questions at bobsiegel.net.
Welcome back to our program. Well, a couple days ago, I was contacted by a pastor who I had never met. He's a Facebook friend. I'd never met him in person. And he told me about a story that's not getting a whole lot of press, although you can read about it on the UK Telegraph and BBC News. Came out November 12th, well, a couple days before, and then got updated more November the 12th. And he was saying, Pastor Siegel, can you please do something about this? He might have misunderstood the sphere of my influence because I don't think I'm that much influential, but it's a conscience thing with me, literally. I certainly want to add my part to doing what I can about it. So since I have a radio show, and tomorrow night, by the way, I'm going to be guest hosting the Rick Amato show again from 9 o'clock to 10 o'clock. And I'll talk about it there too. I also do a column for the Washington Times, and I wrote about it. So I am doing what I can. I must say, in the age of the internet, though, even if you have a small influence, you end up having a bigger one, because there's already a woman in Turkey who just one day later responded back to what I wrote about this in the Washington Times. But here's the story, and I did mention a little bit to you about it before we went on the break. Asiya Bibi, a 45-year-old Christian woman and mother of five, has been condemned by a Pakistani court for blaspheming the prophet Muhammad. Mrs. Bibi insists no such blasphemy took place. Her relatives are appealing the ruling. Now, here's what I want to emphasize, people. Whatever she may have truly said or not said, and I wasn't there and you weren't there, but keep in mind that for many, many Muslims, adherence to Christianity is itself blasphemy, since Christians do not view Muhammad as a prophet of God. I mean, this should be very apparent. How can Christians view Muhammad as a prophet of God when the Quran denies the deity of Jesus, denies salvation through Jesus? Those are two non-negotiable theological pillars for any follower who takes biblical authority to heart. Now, I know there's a lot of Christians who claim they believe in the Bible, and it doesn't really matter to them whether Jesus is the way to God, and they say Jesus is the way to God, and Buddha is the way to God, and Muhammad's the way to God. That's fine. You can believe whatever you want, but when you actually read the Bible, and you read it with an understanding and a belief that it has authority, that it comes from the God of the universe, then you're not allowed to go to those conclusions. Exclusive claims in the name of Jesus, I should say, though, are no more dogmatic than the Quran's insistence that Allah alone is God, or that heaven is forbidden to any who doubt Muhammad's revelations. For this reason, blasphemy is often in the eye of the beholder. Being a Christian need not translate into disrespect for other religions, merely disbelief in other religions. Then again, when a Christian is sentenced to death in the name of Islam, respectful faces drop their jaws. They also remember that these days it does not take much to blaspheme Muhammad. When a Danish newspaper published a cartoon of Muhammad, riots and burnings broke out all over the world. When Dutch film director Theo van Gogh made a movie about the mistreatment of women in Muslim countries, he was stabbed to death on the street in broad daylight for saying that, gee, that ought to teach us to stop calling Islam a violent religion. When it was falsely, and I mean falsely, reported that an American prison guard in Guantanamo Bay flushed a Quran down the toilet, Muslims committed murders in retaliation. But that's nothing. Some Muslims have threatened violence if an infidel so much as touches the Quran. Ironically, there did not seem to be much Muslim outrage around the world when Jewish synagogues were burnt down immediately after Israel turned Gaza over to the Palestinians. Hopefully, American citizens right now are praying for Asiya Bibi. Hopefully, they're also outraged enough to write their congressman so that public opinion might encourage President Obama to put some kind of pressure upon our ally, Pakistan. And it's hard for me to say ally with a straight face, but technically they are our ally. Of course, they're hiding Osama bin Laden, but yeah, they're our ally. Obama certainly spoke up enough about human rights while running for president, didn't he? He also expressed his terrific enthusiasm for international law. So a word or two about a Christian woman sentenced for execution by a government we work with is not out of order. still, don't hold your breath. Obama has already gone around the world in his magical mystery apology tour, explaining to Muslims how America has its own share of guilt. Those same speeches reinforced popular notions that Islam is a wonderful religion, mostly peaceful, yet distorted and misrepresented by a few terrorists. Asiya Bibi's sentence challenges such a religious interpretation. Think about it. Her condemnation comes from the highest court in a Muslim country, not some renegade band. Undoubtedly, many listeners are arming themselves right now with defensive questions. So here, I'll save you the trouble. You're thinking, Bob, are you denying the existence of peaceful Muslims? No, I'm not. Of course, there are peaceful Muslims. Stop clutching your chest. Relax. I've personally, in fact, participated in warm talks and exchanges with wonderful, loving Muslims. However, whereas every Muslim must be judged on an individual basis, evaluating the Quran itself is quite another matter. This collection of Muslim scripture really does call upon Muslims to conquer the world, offering infidels the choice of converting or dying. I'll tell you where you can find that. Surah 9, or Chapter 9 of the Quran. By the way, I read the Quran years ago, before it became fashionable to read it, long before 9/11. When you're out doing campus ministry, issues come up way ahead of time, before the rest of the world catches on. And Islam was an issue on campuses long ago. And of course, when I'm out on a college campus, if somebody starts saying something about the Bible, I'll always ask them if they've actually read the Bible. Have you really read it? Word for word, cover to cover. You're not just going to some anti-Christian website. So to be fair, I sat down and I read the Quran. I also read the Book of Mormon. I also read the Bhagavad Gita. That's just fair. So I read the Quran word for word long before all this stuff happened. I'm telling you, as somebody who's just plain read the thing, it really does tell Muslims to conquer the world, offering infidels the choice of converting or dying. It does. What can I say? Well, yeah, Bob, but only terrorists take those words seriously. No, not so. It is true that terrorists, sadly, are interpreting the Quran accurately, but many Muslims who do not identify themselves as terrorists still abide by their own book, which makes sense. After all, to them, the Quran is sacred scripture. So of course they're going to abide by it. Will you abide by your radio? Because we'll be right back to continue this stimulating discussion. This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539. W&S Electric. Welcome back to our program. There's a Christian woman who's been accused of blaspheming the Prophet Muhammad. She was sentenced by a Pakistani court to be executed. It's being appealed. And I was mentioning before the break that since this is coming from the highest court in a Muslim country, we can't say, oh, well, it's just a few nutcase terrorists doing it. So that's raising the issue of, well, does the Quran really command people to do those things? And I'm saying, yes, it does. And it's not just a Muslim terrorist. Any Muslim who wants to be straight with his faith is going to take the Quran seriously. Well, if that's the case, how do we account for moderate Muslims? Am I saying that there's no such thing as a moderate Muslim? No, I'm not saying that, but let me answer your question with carefulness, with delicacy. Certainly, there are numerous Muslims who call themselves moderate. At the same time, many people who have not studied the religion rush to defend Islam and end up speaking in a vacuum. If the Quran is read word for word and cover to cover, a cold, painful truth sets in. There are many nominal Muslims who would be surprised at what their own holy book says. What does nominal imply? Well, just as there are people who live in America or Europe who know absolutely nothing about the Bible other than a few choice sections taken out of context, people who nevertheless call themselves Christians because they were raised with some kind of church background, there are likewise many people born into Muslim countries or raised by Muslim families. If you asked them if they believed in the Quran, they would say yes. If you asked if they believed in jihad, they would deny it, and they would be telling the truth. There are millions of such people, and yes, we can call them peaceful Muslims. They are peaceful Muslims. Meanwhile, another faction of Islam demonstrates deep familiarity with the Quran. They're aware of the jihad verses, but they choose to reinterpret the jihad verses. There was an Iranian doctor a couple of years ago made himself famous with the claim that jihad meant a war against bacteria. A war against bacteria. Okay, now that's a nice idea, and certainly the kind of Quran application most Americans would welcome, even if it does force objective literary criticism to stand on its head. But let's be grateful for countless Muslims who reinterpret their own holy book, but let's not be grateful at the expense of being naive as to what those scriptures truly say, because we're living in a world where people are taking them very seriously. But Bob, isn't it possible that the literal jihad verses are being taken out of context? Yes, in all literature, there is always a danger of misunderstanding context, but authentic context is verified by asking what a book's original author honestly meant to say. Muhammad himself conquered with a sword. How do you think he took Mecca? For that reason, it's fairly obvious, albeit not politically correct, to understand that such jihad commands were intended by Muhammad to be taken literally and not figuratively. Many Americans have difficulty embracing this uncomfortable idea. Pakistani courts find it more palatable. Just ask Asiya Bibi. Folks, I hope you'll write your local congressman. Like I said, I don't know if that will do much good. I'm not saying any of this will work. I'm saying we should try it. 1-888-344-1170 if you want to weigh in. You can also reach me questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions@bobsiegel.net. Every once in a while, I get a whole batch of questions from our skeptical friend, Alex, person who wants to believe in Christianity, but somehow has trouble. He asks good questions and honest questions, and he sent me about five of them here. I'll read his questions one at a time. Bob, the entire how old is the universe argument. I realize the Bible does not state the world is 6,000 years old. Now, he's saying that because he raised this question me once before, and I made the point that you don't have to jump to any conclusions about how old the Bible is when you read it, and there are many Christians who would disagree with me. What people do is they add up the different generations, but what I had pointed out to Alex is we have no idea how long Adam and Eve were in the garden. They could have been there a million years. They were living in immortality, so we don't really know how old the world was. I had also mentioned to Alex that I believe it was an entire community of people that were banished from the garden, not just Adam and Eve. I base that on the fact that people are always thinking that Cain is Eve's first son. Well, he wasn't her first son. He was her first son born in pain. She didn't have pain in childbirth before, but the commandment to be fruitful and multiply was given back in the garden. And when Cain got banished for killing his brother Abel, he was afraid that he was going to run into some people that were going to hurt him. And he expressed that concern to God, and God put a mark on him to protect him. Well, where were these other people coming from if it hadn't been a whole community banished? So anyway, Alex is familiar with some of my arguments, but he keeps running into Christians that want to give him a more literalistic view of this. So he says, I realize the Bible does not state the world is 6,000 years old, but that seems to be the general feeling. I think it has something to do with if you count the amount of years between Adam and Eve and Jesus. You said to me in the past that the number I stated is the number of years between Adam and Eve and Jesus since Adam and Eve exited the garden. At least it was something like that. So again, he's kind of calling back to mind what I had told him. If this is so, I cannot honestly see how they were in there for billions of years. It seems too far-fetched. Well, again, the reason you can't honestly see that, Alex, is because they were not living as mortal human beings at that time. They were living in eternity. So who knows how long they might have been there. Also, we don't know how long the world might have been created before Adam and Eve were even created either. That's another whole issue. Why doesn't it say in the Bible they were there for the billions of years? Why doesn't it say that in the Bible? Because, Alex, deceptive as a title like Genesis may be, Genesis is a book 50 chapters in length. Only three of those chapters deal with creation. Actually, only 1.5 of those chapters deal with creation. Three of them deal with creation and the Garden of Eden story and man and woman being banished from the garden. Just a couple more chapters for the flood, Tower of Babel. And then it slows down with intricate detail when we get to the story of Abraham and his family. This tells us something about the priority of the writer. Moses, when he wrote the book of Genesis, was quickly reviewing some oral traditions that the Hebrews evidently already would have known. He wasn't supplying detail because they already knew the detail. The Bible was not intended to be a science book. The famous apologist Cliff Connectley says it perfectly. He says, the Bible merely says, in the beginning, God, not in the beginning, hydrogen. Now, having said that, let me move on to his next question. Alex's minor detail, he's still on Genesis. Minor details like that light was created on the second day, and then the sun and moon, which gives the earth light, were recorded on day 4. I mean, is the Bible trying to tell us that we do not get our light from the sun and the moon? Because how could there be light if there is nothing providing it? Another thing is a talking snake. I mean, why are there no talking snakes today tempting us to do stuff? Oh boy, where do I begin? The light or the snakes? Shall I begin with the light or the snakes? I'm not going to tell you. You're going to have to come back and find out. Your own website without a lot of cost and trouble? Hi, I'm Bob Siegel, here to tell you about Web Studio. Web Studio allows people to create their own websites simply and easily without knowing HTML. With Web Studio, you avoid the learning curve of front page and the expense of a web designer. Web Studio has 14 different galleries that contain graphics, sounds, and everything else you need. For more information about Web Studio, go to webstudio.com. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. I'm reading some questions from our good friend Alex. I appreciate his very blunt, honest questions. He's talking about the fact that the sun and the moon was created on day 2, and yet God had said light right away. Day 2 and the sun and the moon, which gives the earth light, were created on day 4, he says. Okay, he's saying light was created on day 2, and then he says, yes, that's right. You got it correct, Alex. It was on day 4. Well, I've said this before in the program. Genesis chapter 1 is written as a poem. Now, I know a lot of people don't want to hear that kind of answer. The Bible is a wide variety of different kinds of literature. The entire book of Psalms, the entire book of Proverbs, most of the book of Job, Song of Solomon, Ecclesiastes are written as poetry. We understand Hebrew poetry by studying it today. We can take a look at the structure of a psalm and compare it to Genesis chapter 1. It was very common in those days, and we do have ancient writings contemporary of the book of Genesis to compare this to, such as Egyptian writings. It was very common to write a poetic overview of an account followed by a detailed account. When you get to chapter 2, they change the order again, but in chapter 2, they're not writing it as a poem. When we get to the stuff about Adam and Eve in the garden, and just to show you, I'm not trying to slide them under the rug, Adam and Eve in the garden is written as a historical narrative. So I would take that literally. But I don't read a poem the way I would read a historical narrative. You don't read Psalms and places in the Bible where it says things like the trees are clapping their hands, the rocks are crying out to God. They say those kinds of things. Now, I know that animal rights activists may love that, pantheists may love that. That's not what the Bible's trying to say. But when you read in Romans that all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, see, what some people try to do with the Bible is they play apples with oranges. They compare apples with oranges. They go, well, if you're not going to take the Psalms literally when it says the rocks cry out to God, then why take Paul literally when Paul says we must give our life to Jesus? Because Paul wasn't writing as a poem, and David was writing a poem. Genesis chapter 1 is written as a poem, and so it doesn't matter about the order. We're not supposed to look at that and look at some kind of blueprint or order. And I hope that's helpful. Now, Alex also brought up the thing about the talking snake. The word there is serpent, and in Hebrew, that word literally means luminous one. Now, of course, we read that word, so we think of a snake as we understand it today. This was some kind of intelligent creature in the garden. If you go to the book of Revelation, they identify that serpent as being one and the same as Satan. And we know other things about Satan. Satan was an angelic being. But when Satan was cursed, God spoke it in a way, and again, even in that curse, a little bit of poetry was thrown in. When the serpent was cursed, God said, on your belly you will go. Now, here's something to think about, Alex, and everybody else listening. If, in fact, all cultures go back to the Garden of Eden, and we have found evidence of the Genesis story from cultures outside of Israel, not just in nearby countries such as Syria, but even far away in places like Burma, where they have things that were handed down by different tribesmen, and that makes sense. That's what we should expect. If, in fact, all of us go back to that, then it would make sense that in different cultures, as they're handing this story down, the story might change. And if there was something handed down about the fact that the serpent went on his belly in the sense that he fell, then imagine an early human being, maybe a caveman, maybe some other early human being, looking at a snake and thinking of the story handed down, and he might say to himself, that looks like the serpent that has been described by our ancestors. So we may, and what I'm saying is, we may have named the snake a snake because of the story rather than somebody creating a story about a snake. That's just another way to look at it. But it wasn't a snake as we know it. It was Satan. Satan was, he might have been an angelic being. He was at least a heavenly being who had authority in heaven. And what was his act of rebellion that got him kicked out of heaven? His act of rebellion was that he came down to earth and tempted Adam and Eve in the gardens. Adam and Eve were pronounced as being separated from God. They were cursed because they ate of the forbidden tree. And of course, there was nothing magical about that fruit. God was just testing their obedience. It could have been anything. He could have said, don't throw rocks in the pond. He could have said, don't pull Eve's hair. But the particular test was, don't eat this fruit. They fell into sin. And you see God pronouncing a curse upon males, and then he pronounced a curse upon females, and then he pronounced a curse upon the serpent. And then he says, on your belly you will go, which may have just been a figurative way of saying you were going to fall from heaven to earth. You're going to fall from authority to having no authority. But then years later, because the story gets handed down, somebody looks at this creature called a snake, and he names it after the serpent. But that's not what serpent meant back then, so I hope that's helpful. Serpent meant luminous one. Just got to get that snake out of your mind. Snakes are such ugly-looking creatures. I'd be delighted to get them out of my mind. Anyway, I'm with Indiana Jones on that one. Snakes. Why did it have to be snakes? All right. So now he says, science is so accurate, but religion is based on blind faith. Well, first of all, science has been known to be very inaccurate, Alex. One of the reasons we have new advances in science and new discoveries is because somebody is proving a previously held scientific notion wrong. If you go back and look at textbooks prior to World War II, they were saying you can never split the atom. We've split the atom. But I mostly want to key in on the second part of Alex's statement. Religion is based on blind faith. For many, it is. According to the Bible, it is not supposed to be. Let me say that again. According to the Bible, it is not supposed to be. In the New Testament, faith is defined as obedience. It is not defined as, golly gee, I have no idea whether God is there, but I'll just pretend he is there and live by faith. That is not what the Bible is talking about. When it says we're saved by faith, it means we're saved by making a decision to follow God. We can't do that on our own because of our sin. We need the forgiveness of the cross. We need the help of his Holy Spirit, but that is still the decision. We make a decision to obey Christ. Now, he refers to some things I've told him about before. He asked me once, Alex, if there were any histories contemporary of the Bible that speak of Jesus. And I talked to two that were very close, at least, Josephus, the Jewish historian who was not a Christian, Tacitus, the Roman historian who was not a Christian, both of whom acknowledged that Jesus actually lived and was on trial. And Josephus even says that Jesus did miracles and rose from the dead based on the overwhelming eyewitnesses. But he says, apart from the Bible and maybe written documents, he's saying maybe, I guess he doesn't completely buy it, maybe written documents from Josephus and Tacitus, there is nothing really to back up the claim that Jesus existed, is there? Well, yes. And of course, Josephus and Tacitus are part of that. The New Testament itself is part of that. The New Testament is 27 historical documents. We sometimes do it a discourtesy by putting in this little leather-bound volume with gold-plated pages and our name engraved on the top in a red letter edition. And it gives us the idea this is this quasi-mystical thing. It's a collection of 27 different documents and various eyewitnesses from a multiplicity of individuals about Jesus. And outside of the New Testament, there's stuff beyond Josephus and Tacitus. There's Pliny the Younger. There's Pontius Pilate and the report that he wrote and sent into Emperor Tiberius, which Emperor Tiberius found so overwhelming and so compelling that he actually went to the Roman Senate and asked them to classify Jesus as a Roman god. The Senate didn't do it, but that shows how compelling the evidence. So there's other stuff. Anyway, Alex continues. He says, the Bible was written by several different authors after the time of Jesus. Not one person that wrote something in the Bible ever talked to Jesus. Alex, I know you're saying that sincerely, my friend, but that is simply not true. John is one of the writers. He was a friend of Jesus and a disciple. Matthew was one of the disciples. Mark is writing the words of Peter. Peter was a disciple. Luke was not a disciple, but Luke was a Roman historian, reputed Roman historian, who was investigating Christianity and spoke to many eyewitnesses. There is so much evidence for Jesus Christ compared to other things that we accept in ancient history. It's almost embarrassing to compare them. We'll return to Alex's questions. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's daily blog on townhall.com. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net. Here, you download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. bobsiegel.net.
This is Bob Siegel inviting you to tune in for the Rick Amato Show four nights a week here on 1170 KCBQ. Rick stays on top of the issues local and national. He also does some of the most stimulating interviews you've ever heard. That's the Rick Amato Show Monday through Thursdays from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. here on Intelligent Talk 1170 KCBQ. You can also find Rick on AmatoTalk.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to our program. Reading some good questions from my friend Alex. He made the statement, and I think he was repeating something he heard. And you can go to all kinds of anti-Christian websites and find this. I'm not suggesting that Alex did that. You can read books today written by scholars. And you need to understand all scholars do not agree with themselves. But you can read books by scholars that say John didn't really write John, Mark didn't really write Mark. That is not the testimony of early history. We can read the writings of the apostolic fathers, the men who lived in the second century who knew the apostles. They were in a much better position than somebody today who wants to come up with some new theory about the Bible. You need to understand that for every one of these liberal scholars that tells you Jesus didn't exist or Jesus did exist but didn't do miracles, such as some of the conclusions of the Jesus Seminar, you can always find conservative scholars like Donald Guthrie, like Bruce Metzger, like so many others, like F.F. Bruce, who's a wonderful New Testament scholar, and they'll tell you other things. So it doesn't matter that scholars say things on both sides. The question is, why do scholars say it? And you need to understand that just because somebody has a PhD, that doesn't necessarily mean they're being scholarly. Do you know how the Jesus Seminar, this collection of scholars, came to the conclusion that Jesus Christ didn't really rise from the dead? You know how they came to that conclusion? They took a vote. They took a vote. That was scholarship. One of the men, Marcus Borg, one of the heads of the Jesus Seminar, said before he even began, shamelessly admitted, that he was starting with the assumption of a naturalistic universe, that he was not going to accept miracles, which means he was looking into it with an open mind. I thought scholars were the ones with open minds. And he says, I will not believe in a God who says there's only one way. Now, if he doesn't want to believe in a God who says there's only one way to find him, that's fine. So when he reads Jesus saying that he's the only way to God, he should say, I don't agree with Jesus. That is at least academically honest, but by an amazing, incredible coincidence, Marcus Borg comes to the conclusion that Jesus never made that claim, even though when you read the Gospels, he does make that claim. This is bias. This is the emotion that evangelicals are always accused of having. Frankly, the conservative scholars are being much more objective about this. There is zero evidence that John didn't really write John, that Mark didn't really write Mark, that Matthew didn't really write Matthew. Somebody wants to claim that they didn't do it? That's fine. I know we don't have Doc Brown's DeLorean to fly back there and see for ourselves with any bit of history. And I've said this before on the program, it falls under the category of what I would call evidence. It's not proof unless we see it for ourselves. If you want God proven to you, you need to have a relationship with God. We're going to talk more about that in the weeks ahead. It's possible to have a personal relationship with the Spirit of God. For history, it's the trail of breadcrumbs that God has left us. And in this trail of breadcrumbs, we have overwhelming evidence. If somebody wants to claim that Matthew didn't really write the book of Matthew, or John didn't really write the book of John, the burden of proof is on him. And what kind of proof do they have that those people didn't write it? Nip, zip, zada. Nada, nothing. Then Alex says, what are the chances that a few people could have just made up a load of nonsense thinking they could fool people to get them into believing it? Well, for one thing, these people were willing to die for the joke. I don't think the joke's that funny anymore when John's being exiled to the island of Patmos, or James, the brother of John, is being murdered by King Herod, one of the many, many Herods in the Bible. Now, is it possible? Anything's possible, Alex, but not all things are probable. Yes, rumors, and then Alex goes on to say, rumors are easily spread. Yes, rumors are easily spread. There's also a historical method. There are ways of testing things through history, and that's the amount of witnesses, the corroboration, that's archaeology. Not only is the resurrection of Jesus Christ one of the most well-attested events of ancient history, we have archaeological evidence for the fall of Jericho. We have archaeological evidence for the parting of the Red Sea. We found an Egyptian spoke wheel from an Egyptian chariot wheel. The Egyptians have done us a great favor of leaving their history in 3D. We can look at their carvings on their walls and look at the kinds of wheels they had in the days of Ramses II. You know, Yul Brynner, the guy that Yul Brynner played in the Ten Commandments. And we actually see a chariot wheel on the bottom of the Gulf of Aqaba, which is evidently where the Red Sea was in those days. The term Red Sea included a much greater area than it does today. Gulf of Aqaba, connecting the Sinai Peninsula with the Arabian Peninsula. Then you go to the other side on the Arabian Peninsula. There's a mountain there called Jebel Alas. On the top, it's blackened as if fire came down from the mountain. There's figurines of calves. There's this great big rock that looks like it was split open by water. I mean, the evidence is overwhelming. Overwhelming. I know this sounds too good to be true. Or if you don't want to believe in the Bible, and if you'd rather live a life of selfishness, maybe it sounds too bad to be true. That's not the case with our friend Alex. I'm convinced that Alex is really seeking God and really wants to believe him, but he keeps bumping into people who are saying that there's no evidence for the Bible. And frankly, I think he's bumping into a few Christians who are telling him to just accept it by faith. Sometimes Christians do the greatest disservice to what they're supposed to be following. Well, Alex continues, different kind of question now. I do not understand how God has always existed and how he could also create things from nothing. Something has to have a beginning, right? But let me stop you right there, Alex. You just gave one of the greatest arguments for the existence of God, and I know that's not the point you're trying to make. But you're making the point that you can't get something out of nothing. I would add to that that you can't get the personal from the impersonal. The universe by itself and the items of the universe, such as gas, such as stars, such as chemicals, that doesn't think by itself. So when we're asking where human personality came from, you get the personal from the impersonal or the personal from the personal? It makes sense that we get the personal from the personal. And if you can't get something out of nothing, we can add this up like an equation. Something had to always exist. 0 + 0 = 0. The reverse of that would also be true. Something must come from something. Personality must come from personality. So if something had to always exist, that something had to be an eternal personality. Now, having said that, if God himself exists, how does God create things from nothing? Alex says, something just cannot always be there because that makes no sense. I mean, if he was always there, what did he do all the time in complete darkness? How could he create things from nothing? How could he just say, let there be light, and then light appears? I mean, where did the light come from? How can light just come from absolutely nothing? If he was in darkness all the time, how would he know what light was? How did he make planets? What did he make them from? He had nothing, right? So the idea that he can just say stuff to absolutely nothing and then things magically appear makes absolutely no sense at all. Well, Alex, the Bible doesn't say that they magically appear. You're asking a question that's never going to be answered this side of eternity, my friend. How did God create the universe? The Bible does not answer that question, but the alternative is a distinct impossibility. It's a rational, illogical impossibility. The alternative is that we are here according to randomness and chance. The alternative is that something came from nothing, and the alternative is the personal came from the impersonal. You just stated yourself by your very question, Alex, that that can't be true. Now, can I throw out an idea? God always existed and was always complete. There could be something from within himself that he draws upon to create. I suspect that's part of the answer. Then he says, why doesn't God appear? I mean, if he does want people to disbelieve in him and wants everybody to go in, I think he meant to say if he wants people to believe in him, that was a typo. If he does want people to believe in him and wants everyone to go to the kingdom of heaven, then why doesn't he tell them that he exists by coming down himself? Right now, when the population of the world has been at its highest ever, and so has the amount of atheists in the world, why doesn't anybody ever see him or hear him? First of all, Alex, if you go back to one of the earliest stories in the Bible, God did just exactly what you were asking about. He came down to this mountain, Jebel Alas, that I'm talking about, which is in Arabia, what they called Mount Sinai in those days. It's not the same as what they call Mount Sinai today in Israel is not the real Mount Sinai. But he came down to this mountain and he spoke audibly and there were trumpets and there was fire and there were all those George Lucas, Steven Spielberg special effects. He did what people always say they wished he did, and the people got freaked out. And they said, Moses, we don't want to hear this. We can't handle this. We can't stand this. We can't take it. You go up there, listen to God, let God talk to you, and then you come down and tell us what he said. So Moses came down 40 days later, and then they went, now how do we know Moses was really talking to God? Then years later, God came down in the person of Jesus Christ and did many miracles. They executed them, but then he rose from the dead and he appeared to 500 people. And people do hear him today, Alex. That's what I'm going to talk about next week, folks, a personal experience you can have. There are people today who actually hear God speak with an audible voice. I have heard on very rare occasions God speak with an audible voice myself. Don't take my word for it. From your point of view, maybe it was bad pizza, or maybe I'm lying, or maybe, just maybe, there really is a God who really does love you, who really reaches out, who really wants to communicate with you. Wouldn't it be difficult not to at least consider that possibility? Oh, you, my skeptical friends who claim you have such an open mind. I'm glad you have an open mind. Open it a little more. We'll see you next week.
Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.